All right. So today we're going to talk about financing options for first time property buyers. So if you are hunting for a property for the first time, or if you're planning to save up for your first property, I think this is the right banter episode for you. So welcome to our NOTG banter. It's good to have our home team or core team or
the OGs.
This is not the OGs. Have we even done an episode together?
Then second time, yeah. Probably.
Yes, la, of course.
You always quarrel.
Second and episode.
We done two rounds.
Second and I know episode. I always see him, but I don't remember seeing George.
What you talking about?
No, there was an episode we did with George, la. I think it was like the new launch one.
Yeah, George is one of the most famous.
Okay, then financing options for second plan property, no need.
And we're also going to talk about how do you save effectively, efficiently for your first down payment for your new home. Of course, this is going to be an increasing challenge through the years because the leverage percentage is now dipping. I mean, it has really deep from all the way from in the past, it was like 90% to 85% to 80% to 75% right now. So we're also going to talk about accumulation habits to save up for your first property, plus talk about some of the property news for the past 2 weeks. So thanks, Grace, for working with the team to design the new NOTG cups. How long did we take to design this, by the way?
Not very long, because we already had the stickers. There's an NOTG sticker pack, by the way. You can search.
Is it for sale?
No, like on Instagram. On Instagram, you can search, I think, PLB NOTG. Then you can use our stickers if you're watching us.
We should start our, like,
merchandise.
A merch. Is it called merch?
Merch. Merch. But you can invent the word.
Merc.
Merc.
The
M-E-R-K.
The merch.
M-E-R-C-H.
The merch is very
murky. Always anyhow spelling on.
Everything becomes murky. Everything becomes murky.
But people still follow. So
everything becomes murky.
I invented a lot of new vocabulary over the years.
P-L-B Merc.
Okay, I'm just going to put it on the website. M-E-R-K. Click on this button to buy our merch. Okay. We're going to talk about maybe this scenario first. Assuming, I don't know about you guys. Okay, I know about you guys. I know your background. So I know all about your background. Okay. I know this guy for 10 over years. I know this girl for 2 over years. I know this guy for 10 over years. I was the one that helped him buy his first property through him. And that was strange. So I brought him to buy a property through him. He was representing a developer. I was representing him before he became a realtor.
Yeah.
Okay. All of us came from average family, humble backgrounds. Okay. So for today's episode, we're going to talk about this scenario. That means average Singaporean growing up. We come from our average family, go through education route. Whether it's poly, JC or uni, started work. And then, of course, if let's say you happen to be somebody in your early, maybe mid to late 20s or maybe early 30s, and you are navigating your career, and at the same time, maybe you're dating, planning to commit to your marriage and then want to get your first property, whether is it a BTO, or if you're doing well professionally, you want to get your first condominium, or maybe you want to get your first resale HDB. How do you first kickstart to save up for your first set of down payment? Very easy to navigate in these two spectrum. If you're going for a private property, you need a minimum of 5% cash, 20% CPF, plus of course stamp duty. We always use a very short form formula. You need to have a 29% down payment because 25% is your cash and CPF. About 4% is your stamp duty and legal fees.
Yep.
HGB has a different route because there are grants to help you with that. So let's just assume a couple. Let me talk about a couple first. Planning for the first property and they are trying to navigate HGB or private property. And a lot of the decision factor boils down to the down payment. Because a lot of people, because they don't have the first set of down payment for private, they have to go for HDB first. So maybe you want to share your thought process about how do you effectively save up your first set of down payment?
How to effectively save up? I think we need to understand whether the profile, is your profile like a commission-based, like ourselves, or is it like a freelancer, or you are like in terms of like a fixed income payroll, right? In terms of like fixed income payroll, of course, it is way easier because you already have CPF contribution. You will stash away 20% of your monthly income, of course, at $6,000. Company will pay 17%, right? So if you are young, below 35, this 37% will split into three accounts, right? So your ordinary account, which you can use to pay for the down payment for a property, will be 23% of your monthly income capped at $6,000. So that effectively helps you to quickly accelerate these savings. So for example, we give an example, right? If let's say, assuming income of, I forgot what numbers that I input just now.
Anyway,
okay, assuming $5,000 income.
Right.
Right. And then 23%, right, contribution is like 1150 per month. Mm. And assuming in a 5-year time frame, using the 2.5% compounded interest rate of your CPF ordinary account, right, you will have $72,537 in your CPF ordinary account in 5 years time. So you and your partner, that will double up to be about almost like $144,000, $145,000. Then if you're safe, individually during these 5 years, $50,000, $50,000 each, actually you can get a decent property.
Right. Mm. So that will work out to be about 250,000. Mm. Okay. George, with that scenario, I mean, there's many different scenarios, but okay, we have to eliminate some of the so-called possible scenarios. For example, there's no help from family members. There's no help from your parents.
Mm.
There's no inheritance that's passed down to you. No external help. Basically, you're working your way to save and accumulate for a first set of down payment. So with that scenario, young couple, 5 years time, CPF will build up to 72,000 each. That will be about 144,000. And if they can save 50,000 cash each, right? You're talking about that, right? Okay. In 5 years, that means per year, you have to save $10,000 cash per person, which means per month, you must save $800.
Yeah,
right?
Around there.
And that is, of course, doable. Provided, of course, the income is about $5,000 each. Then maybe they are in their mid-20s or late-20s, example, or early-30s. Okay. What property can you buy with $250,000?
I think ballpark, you can look at about, say...
And what would you advise this couple?
Really like, cap at about $1 million. Yeah, really. Yeah, 900 plus to about $1 million. I think based on this budget, you can probably go towards the city fringe first.
Mm-hmm.
Start off something from the city fringe. After all, there's a lot of transaction volume at the city fringe. You can buy into something, say that's a 2-bedder. Start off from there first. Some 2-bedder, right, layouts that I've seen can actually allow you to create a third bedroom. You can potentially use that as a pivot home first. Yeah, then...
Explain what is a pivot home. And, so, by the way, this was invented by PWK. What is the pivot home?
Invented by
we should trademark
by Mr. Merck. Yeah, Mr. Merck.
So Okay, wait. Okay. Coming back to the context, right? Because we started out with $250,000. $140,000 plus about $100,000 cash. We just round out $250,000.
Mm.
The calculation method is like this. Maybe have George to zoom in a little bit. If you have $250,000 CPF and cash, the quick formula is to divide by 0.29. Of course, that will work out to be about 862,000 total quantum price. Actually, the comfortable figure is to have about 290,000. So if you divide by 0.29, that gives you an overall budget of about $1 million to go for. So $1 million, 75% is from the bank, 25% is $250,000 down payment, and then about 4% is buyer stamp duty as well as your legal fee, plus minus a little bit. So let's just take an example because George is talking about $1 million budget, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so how would you advise this couple? Like, do you think that they should go for a private property or they should go into like a HDB first?
Right. So I think sometimes the mindset we want to adopt is we do not just want to see what is our current situation now and we buy into it now. I think it's always good to say you think about maybe 2 steps forward. Because at this current age, when you're still young, you actually have a lot of ability to increase your salary as you progress. Mm. So you might say, okay, I want to stretch myself a little bit if I really can. I go for something that I can potentially buy and then still have the ability to rent in future. And that's what we call a pivot home. That means short term is something that I can stay first and then eventually that particular layer allows me to say I cover another bedroom or it can be like a dual key setup and then I use that as a rental. And then in future, once my income increases, which is expected if you work hard, then yeah, you can easily, you know, jump start to the next property type as well.
Mm. You're talking about the pivot home, meaning that you go for a entry level condominium first,
yep.
And very likely you are talking about a resale condominium.
Yes.
As in like a outer core region.
Yeah, outer core region.
Mass market region.
Yes.
A 2-bedder.
Yeah.
Around $1 million.
Minimally, yes.
Okay. maybe share with our audience, which areas can you get $1 million now? I mean, which are the housing estates?
I think you can definitely look at Punggol, Sengkang, Two Bader, or if not, you can look at Yishun, Woodlands. You can still find properties of this price point. You can just easily enter into these areas.
Okay, great. Mm. Grace, this scenario that Yu Rong started out for us is to save up for 5 years first. Mm. And assuming this couple don't want to wait for 5 years.
Yeah.
And what would be your advice for them?
Okay, so when Yu Rong was laying out the scenario of saving up for 5 years, then a thought came into my head, which was that in these 5 years, let's say if you were to buy a HDB right from the onset with like all the grants and all that, is it possible that within these 5 years, you can still be saving up for your down payment for the condo while owning a HDB property? So of course, I think this is a strategy that is possible. We can look into the numbers in a bit. But this will be a little bit challenging for, let's say, young couples who are not ready to, let's say, commit. Because let's say if you were to get a HDB, then you have to get married within 3 months of the completion date of your property. So it assumes that you are at a stage where you are ready in life to commit with someone, because for HDB, you cannot get it as a solo. You have to be a matrimonial unit, right, to get it. So assuming you are ready, let's say, you know, people grad at what age? 22
for girls. 22 for guys, guys, like 24, 25.
Yeah. So let's say assuming at 22, 23, you are ready, or 24. In these 5 years of saving up for your first down payment, you instead want to put it into a HDB property. I think that's possible as well. So numbers wise, for the loan to value ratio for HDBs, you have to have, I think for a bank loan, it's 75. It's the same, but for HDB loan, it's at 80. So you need that remaining 20%. So I would think that it will still require a bit of working for maybe 20%. Okay, let's say you buy a 500. Is 500k very expensive?
500,000. If 20%, it will be 100k lah.
400k.
Yeah. Actually, you could cover it mainly from grants.
From if grants, you're, yeah.
Yeah. So technically, actually, if you are so-called ready to buy a home and all that, you are ready to get married, settle down, right? I think it's quite a good idea to buy into a HDB flat first, make use of the grants. So a common misconception is that the grants have to be returned to the government when you sell a HDB. That's not true. The grant amount is actually returned into your CPF account. Of course, you need to pay the accrued interest that, you know, for the month-to-month that it has accumulated and the entirety, but it will go into your own CPF account, which you can then use for your next property.
In summary, grants are given to you, accredited into your CPF account, so it is your money.
Yep.
In scenarios where you need to refund, that will be in scenarios where, like, divorce cases, right, within the MOP period, or like there are certain things that we did not fulfill, like a time period. For example, you get a proximity grant, and within the 5 years, you either need to shift away 4 kilometers away from where the proximity location is, then you have to refund this. If not, then there is yours. So generally wise, in terms of grant wise, we now know that it is $80,000 for buying a HD resale flat if you buy 4-room flat and below. Right. So in that scenario of buying a 500k property, assuming that you only need 20% of down payment, that was up to 100,000, 80k is taken care of by grant. So you only need that 20k of saving. So of course, then that will definitely shorten the amount of time that you need to buy your first HD property, for example. This is assuming that we are in a scenario where, number one, you want to use the least amount of cash outlay, and second thing, you have found the right partner. Because we marriage should be prioritized, as in like the right partner should be prioritized over property. We don't get married to, like, you know, like get a property, right? In that scenario of 5 years that we save for is, for example, if let's say you haven't decided who you want to spend the rest of your life with yet, right? Just continue to, like, save first, you know, even as a with a friend or with a couple, you can always co-invest first with people with the right mindset. So you don't need to always be buying a property yourself. You don't have to always be buying a property with like your potential partner.
This is also given that we are in a climate now that a lot of people are also renting, right? So a lot of young people, they want to rent. I think after they grad, you know, they want to move out, they're renting their own place. So instead of putting that money into rent, it may be a good idea to put it into mortgage. And then the mortgage part also can be covered by your CPF. So that is something to think about.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Yurong. I mean, this sounds a little bit like a counseling marriage advice as well, which is, I think is important. So just now, I think what you said about prioritizing your marriage above the objective of getting your first property, I think that is extremely important. Okay, maybe share a little bit about the co-investing part, because I think for young couples, you have to be careful in terms of co-investing. I think what Yurong meant was that co-investing has various options. There's commercial property, industrial property, and all that. But you have to be very careful about using your name for residential property, because let's say you co-invest with two friends who are maybe more matured and their names are already used up in their own residential property and your name has not been utilized, but you have earning power, good credit score. And if you want to co-invest with two person, which are your friends, and they want to utilize your name, take note that if you want to reverse that thing 3 to 5 years later when you want to get married, you will hit a scenario whereby you need to extract your name out from that, and that might be a stalemate for you. Maybe share a little bit about the co-investing.
Okay, so of course, in terms of co-investing, I think number one, you must find the right kind of partners, the right investment kind of mindset. Like, you have a clear horizon of like, what's the objective of buying this property, right? Maybe it's for like appreciation, to help you to double up the money that you have put into this property, so that each of y'all can roll the money in a way that y'all can own your own property 3 to 5 years down the road, right? But of course, we want to also partner with people that has the right mindset, the right kind of holding period. Like, for example, like we can commit like for a certain period, like 3 years, 5 years, etc. And you will definitely sell to unlock everybody's name. And of course, this, we need to assume that we want to work with, let's say you co-invest in a private property, right? And that is also assuming that you are giving away the opportunity for yourself, right, to buy a HDB. Because of the new measure that we need to, if you're under 55 years old, you need to sell a private property, wait out for 15 months before you can buy a resale HDB flat, or you have to wait 30 months after you sell a private property to actually apply for a BTO. And so usually, what we say is that like, once you go to that private route, right, it's harder to come back to return to go and buy a HDB. Once, so this is, of course, side, something that you have to consider carefully. But of course, that 15 months wait period for a resale property, I think that's still quite a temporary measure. Probably, I think it might be removed from the market 1.5-2 years down the road.
Yeah, and take note of this co-investing part, because it affects your spouse as well. So for example, how HDB views a couple is that they view them as one body. So for example, if let's say you co-invested in a residential private property with two friends, and even though, let's say, you guys head up to a law firm, sign an agreement saying that, okay, in the next 5 years, at a 5th year mark, we'll sell, clear my name. And let's say if you successfully sell, that 15 months cooling off period applies to you and your spouse together. It doesn't mean that only your name was utilized for the private property. Your spouse can still go ahead and buy a HDB property. So both of you are tied in together. If you want to go for, let's say, a BTO, BTO has a longer waiting period. It's 30 months. Resale is 15 months. So just to take note of that. Okay, Josh, I want to come to you on this part.
Okay, wait. Before that, right, just one pointer also. It's not just who you buy with, it's also what you buy. So I think recently my friend, he texted me and he asked, okay, I want to co-invest with two other people. We want to buy a one bidder. Yeah, so I think, without knowing, you know, too much about like which one bidder or which project this is, the initial kind of thoughts is that, I think probably they're looking at one bidder because of, maybe the quantum. They want to keep the quantum low, three people, you know, they want to pull together the down payment and then, finance the monthly mortgage. Then they're thinking that the rent, will likely be good, the rental yield. But I think one thing to take note of is that it's not just the rental yield of this property that you're holding it. It's also the capital appreciation. Right, so we always say there are two vehicles to investment property. One is the rent that you'll get. The second is the capital appreciation that you will earn throughout the period that you are invested. So I think not saying that one bidders don't have a good capital appreciation. I didn't study which is the project that he's talking about. But generally, the target audience for one bidders might not be as big as, let's say, three or four bidders where you have family types buying for own stay. And then one bidders, you're mainly looking at investor types also. So the price is unlikely to be too far off from whatever is the market valuation. Yeah, so that was just something to take note of.
But I think there are two important points, right? That's why when I mentioned about co-investing, I think this is a very viable strategy for like people who are singles. I get an example, right? So when I think it was like my third or fourth year in real estate, my JC teacher approached me. So when he approached me, he was 35 years old. right? And his initial thought process actually was to get a HDB, since now he is eligible, he has been waiting to own their own property, right? And then usually, I think many Singaporeans, because of the mindset of parents, okay, you should own a HDB as your first property. So he waited until 35. After I spoke to him on the market, he decided to go to a private property. Mm. But just imagine that he already has the funds. He's ready in terms of cash and CPF. But if let's say, you know, like you were to meet the right person, you could have already invested in a vehicle that has already appreciated during the time of waiting. So sometimes not everybody will get married, right? So I think co-investing can be one of the good options, assuming you can find the right partner, choose the right deal. And of course, I think we always, even though in our channel, we always mention that if you have a choice, buy bigger properties, like 3 bedders, 4 bedders, right? But we also want to give a balanced view that we are not saying that 1 bedder and 2 bedder are not worth investing in, because we think about the portfolio as a stepping up process, meaning that we should get into whatever, as long as it's a good property, of course, we should get into something that we can afford first. Because most of the time, the property, in terms of their total return appreciation plus the rental that you collect, right, will outpace for most people their savings rate. Mm. Right. So if I wait to save to buy a bigger property, right, actually it will be, by the time I accumulated, right, that property that I want has already went up much further than my savings rate. So it's okay to still enter a 1 bedder. I mean, like, we also have like research that, you know, like, for example, Park Astar, right? So Park Astar, their 1 bedder's average annualized gain, 4.7%. Their 3 bedder annualized gain is about 7.3%, right? So it's still appreciated, right? And if you have leveraged it, your CAGR at 4.7% gain, that will be times 3. CAGR meaning your return per year is compounded, right?
Yeah, compound and no go.
Yeah, so that already gives you about like a 12% in terms of like how your money has grown just holding the property for 3 years, right? So of course, right property selection is important. And every time, once we have reached the stage that we can actually expand the portfolio by 30%, 40%, 50%, because, you know, like your equity has built up or your loan has built up, then we can buy a bigger property.
Yeah. Mm. Thanks. So later we will talk a little bit more about the singles route. Let's come back to that young couple again, earning $5,000, no help from family, parents, and of course, they let's leverage on Grace scenario. So assuming right now, so maybe I'll pose this question to George. Assuming sure. right now, and I think this is very beneficial for our audience. This young couple is ready to commit and they are in a dilemma, all right? And then George, they come to you. They ask you, George, we're ready to get married. We're now thinking about, should we save up for the next 5 years to accumulate and own our first private property? Or should we go straight into resale HDB first for this 5 years? Because anyway, the MOP period, minimum occupation period is 5 years. Then we switch to that private property. Mm. Or should we go with the third option, is to wait 5 to 7 years, apply for a BTO, wait 5 to 7 years, get the keys to my BTO. These three options, what would you advise?
Okay, so we eliminate first. I'll personally eliminate the third choice because I think the waiting time is way too long. And they might price out, because if they're going for the BTO routes, if they get a very good number, then they will have to wait for the 4 years and then plus another 5 years, that's 9 years down. If they get a good number, if not, it might be even longer and longer and longer, because we have actually clients that actually waited for BTO for like, I think, two years plus or 3 years, and they cannot even get a good unit number. So I will rule that out first. For that two options, right, I think it boils down to what is their spending habits and whether do they do any form of investment. Let's explore the second route first, which is, say, to buy a HDB, a resale HDB. Because just like what Grace mentioned, your entry price is low, so your outlay is very little. Back to what Yurong said, like, you know, your CAGR is like, say, 4 to 5%. And if, let's say, you are able to use the rest of your cash money to go and save up consistently, and let's say $5,000 is your income, you less out the 20% for your OA contribution, your CPF contribution, you have about $4,000, and then you maybe set aside another $1,000 plus, you go and buy into stocks and you get into those very good stocks. Say just talk about very safe stocks like REITs. That means it's not even like US market. And then you get all this yield of like 4 to 6%. And if you can do all that, I think it's still okay to buy into a HDB. And then you use that money to kind of say, I outweigh whatever potential gain that I might have for a condo or private property, assuming the growth is there, then I think that will still be okay. But if let's say you are the kind of mindset, okay, I want to just go all in and I just buy into something that I need to stretch myself. I go into a condo, or I go into a private property, maybe 900 plus thousand. And then, you know, I choose a right property that can give me that kind of good benefits. Then I think either okay, of
let,
these
let
two
me
will
recap my question. Mm. Thanks. So my question is, this couple now has nothing. That means they got no savings at all.
Mm.
Because we're back at the scenario. You need 5 years to build up your 72K CPF each and your 50K cash each to hit that 250 to 290,000.
Right.
You have nothing now. Now 2023. By 2028, then you have that set of down payment. Mm. So what should be the right option for this couple? Because maybe now they're both 25 years old.
Mm.
And they are at a dilemma stage. Some friends are telling them, hey, I don't think you should do anything first. Work hard, save your 290,000 for the next 5 years, then straight away buy a $1 million private property, which of course by then, I don't know whether 2028, we still have a $1 million private property. Okay. So what should be the right step? Would you advise them to, okay, just go for a HDB resale first, these 5 years, get a roof over your head, get some grants, then later sell, and then move to a private, or go in with one name first, provided the rules don't change, then after that, use the other name to buy a private property. Okay, because the other school of thought is that some of their friends might be advising them saying that, hey, I don't think you should even touch a HDB, right? So what do you think will be your advice?
I think it's okay to go for HDB. Just go for a resale one. Just go for maybe a one name. Then after that, use that again as a private home. Because if you go in with one name, then you can just, after the MOP, you can just rent it out all the way. And then lowest entry, just save the money. And then after that, build your reserve to go into the private property.
Right, then we want to clarify for the audience, right? Of course, HDB, when we say going by one name, right? Okay, you still need two names to buy a HDB, but it's a structure between applicant and occupier.
Yeah.
Of course, I think like my question to that couple will be, what industry are they in, first of all? Second thing is, in terms of their own assessment of like how they prioritize career in their life, right? Because when you're in the right industry and, you have a good career path, because of your own, habits and all that, right? Sometimes you realize that actually at the age of, 27 to 35, right? You have extreme high potential of income acceleration.
Yep.
And, sometimes, you know, originally you might think that, the set is tearing down. Okay.
It's dramatic.
Yeah. So imagine, right, like originally, you know, like one might think that they will need like 5-6 years, right, to actually save up this down payment.
Mm.
But because of the acceleration of income, assuming that your spending habits do not, you know, go in tandem with your income increase, right? You could have done the own same savings, right, in like 2 years, 2.5 years.
Yep.
Right. Of course. HDB route, if let's say you feel that like, okay, I don't think in terms of probability wise, I'm in that scenario, then of course, be comfortable to start with a HDB resale first.
Mm.
You maximize out the grant. 80,000 4-room flat. If you can buy something near your parents' home, that is another 20K proximity grant. And you might have a little bit of enhanced housing grant because it is up to 9,000 household income, right? All this grant, assuming that even the price did not go up, right? This will come back to you as your profit because grant is given to you, gets credited to your CPF. And so that helps you to, you know, like build up equity as well while you save. And 5 years time, definitely, if finances are okay, then do consider to restructure this property again. I don't really advise for the applicant occupier route lah. Because actually in all the scenarios I calculated, right? The main scenario is to, optimize in terms of additional buyer's stamp duty. You can own two properties, no ABSD. But actually, right, if you are in a position that you have the means, right, to not sell HDB to come with a down payment to buy another private property, you realize that still unlocking the equity in your HDB will allow your portfolio, right, to grow in such length, right, that it makes more sense to just tear down the HDB. I mean, like, in terms of structure.
Rules are subjected to be changed by HDB. HDB correct. Can always... if they decide to change the rule saying that, okay, from now on, there's no more applicant occupier route. Everybody has to buy under two applicants. Then the rule will change. So of course, this is a disclaimer. I think back on the Yu Rong's point, applicant occupier route has been very popular because it gives the couple an option. That means 5 years later, if they want to sell and then use two names to buy two private property, they have the option. Correct. Even if they want to keep first, rent out the HDB, buy the private, they can also do that. So I think it's like an option.
There's a flexibility.
Kind of Grace.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to also clarify what is this owner-occupier route, because some of the people watching might not know of this kind of policy. Mm. So like what Melvin shared, it's something that is subjected to the government's, you know, measures. It is subjected to change at any time. But as of the time of filming, owner-occupier means that, you know, there is a possibility where, let's say if you were to buy, you still have to buy as a couple.
So if you can explain how does this work, and also share that this works both for BTO and HDB resale. Maybe share how
and,
does this
and EC as well.
Yeah, how does this structure work?
Okay, so basically you still have to buy as a couple, as a family unit.
Nucleus.
But what happens is that you can buy as one person as the main owner and then the other person as the occupier. So in this scenario, your loan and your CPF usage and all that will solely be based on the owner side. Mm. The owner and the occupier, you are both subjected to the 5 years MOP. However, after this 5 years MOP, the name of the occupier is technically free. So the occupier can go ahead and buy a second property and not be subjected to the ABSD. So that is why, this is quite popular for people who want to buy a HDB first, assuming the owner's income and down payment is able to support solely, right, as one person to purchase this HDB, go into a lower quantum HDB, and then, you know, you can keep the HDB and you can rent it out. So why this is very, you know, why some people may be looking into this is also because for the HDB, right, let's say you are able to rent out, the rental yield is significantly higher given that your investment quantum is lower. Let's say you buy like a 300k HDB or 400k three-room HDB. Then in that sense, you're able to rent out, let's say depending on location, right? Let's say 3, 3, 5, 4. You're still able to have a really good investment yield. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. And this is the way that you can own a HDB plus a private property concurrently without incurring ABSD.
Currently, lah. Yeah, but we don't know whether...
The kicker is that 5 years later, that occupier's income must be, the sole income of the occupier must be able
strong
to
enough.
Afford the private property.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, we've been talking a lot about the down payment, right? The other 75% part is contingent on your income. So the bank will take your income and they will do an assessment. So it not necessarily means that if you can afford the 25% down payment and the 4% stamp duty, then you can, you know, be able to get the 75% loan. That is still subjected to your income and the TDSR measures. Yeah.
Mm. Just think though, this one is, MSR. Yeah, so yeah.
Mortgage servicing ratio.
But they only recognize 30% of it.
Okay,
and just, after that, when you want to buy the condo.
Right. Just like you mentioned a very good point, which is you really have to consider the industry and the career and profession you're in, because there has been a lot of people. Of course, when you're young, I think making a decision to get into the HDB property first is good because you want to start a family. Mm. But of course, a lot of people also grow up with I wouldn't say it's a myth, but I would say that maybe based on popular advice, parents, siblings, friends, default option is just get a BTO. You're very safe.
Yep.
And of course, I'm not saying that BTO is no good, because BTO, based on historical data tracking, once you take your keys, you fulfill 5 years MOP, you want to sell, naturally you see a profit margin.
Correct.
Because you enter at a subsidized housing rate.
Yep.
But of course, we also have to take into consideration that you need 1 to 2 years to wait for your queue. Okay. Depend. I mean, if you are okay with OCR in the very outskirts region, I think you can get your home faster. And you need to wait for construction period, which is about 4 to 6 years. That is taking out about a median waiting period of 5 to 6 years. And then you have to wait for 5 years MOP. That is 11 years. Now, in 11 years, naturally, all types of residential properties over the last 11 years has appreciated
a lot. Yes.
With inflation, asset inflation, we are talking about landed condos, HDB resale. BTO, naturally, it will appreciate because you bought in 11 years ago, right? So, just now you mentioned something is to consider your profession, because sometimes during that 11 years period, maybe at the 4th year point, you started doing well. You have bonuses, you have savings, and then you realize that you're stuck because you can actually go for a private property, but you're stuck. You still have 7 years of waiting period because you haven't even gotten your BTO keys yet. Mm. So that is what we mentioned about really sitting down to think about your options on private property, waiting to save for private, go for a resale first, or wait for the BTO. But try not to fall into the trap that you are biased against just one. It is to really look at that three options and then consider your life stage, your career, profession, your in your marriage as well. Then make a very wise decision from there.
Yeah. Right? And like in this, talking about this, right, one thing to take note of or a concept to understand also is time. Right, like in the grand scheme of things, when you are considering your resources or your assets, it's not just about money, it's not just about your loan. A very important factor is also time, the amount of time that you have and your runway for investment. And like, let's say in Singapore, we only have until what, 60 years old.
65.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm not even thinking like in the next, like,
for your loan tenure, huh? You're talking about loan tenure.
No, not loan tenure, it's just like, there's only a certain amount of times that you will be changing hands.
Opportunity cost.
Yeah, and opportunity cost in terms of, let's say you are waiting this long amount of time for your property, then by that time, you know, the market would have shifted.
Well, are you talking about, were you referring to average lifespan?
Okay.
Ladies is 85, guys is 75.
No. Actually, in summary, right, it's point one, right? Singapore real estate, as a form of investment, it will only give you that kind of kegger or exciting returns, right? If we are leveraging, meaning that we are actually taking a bank loan. If you are buying full cash, you are, okay, if you pick a good property buying full cash, maybe you have 5%, 6% annualized gain. It's not too exciting. You can have other instruments that could easily give you 5, 6% at a more liquid version, right? So the reason is because with leverage, you can get a kegger of 20%, 25% if you choose the right property. And that's what makes it exciting for most people from a single real estate investment. But in order for you to leverage, you want to know that we have a limited runway. So most people, so runway will be until about 45 years / 50 years old. Reason is because we can only loan until 65. So that will give you about still at least a 20-year loan to get substantial loan for you to build a portfolio. Of course, if you are, more than 50, we actually have other strategies that we can extend the loan tenure, but it comes with other drawbacks, right? So in short, 30 years to 40, let's say 50 years, right, is 20-year time frame. Every time you buy a property, it's good to think of it in a 5-year cycle in the sense that if you buy a good enough property, irregardless of the economic situation, it should revert to you like a positive kind of return in a very, very high probability standpoint. Looking at 3 years, not every time, every 3 years, you will be able to change hands to have enough profit because of a market situation. So if, let's say 30 or 50, 20-year runway, 5 years means you can only do this 4 times. Then think about it, if you get a BTO, 4 years construction, 5 years MOP, or you're in a PLH plus another 5 more, that's 14 years, right? So this is actually what Grace is talking about, right? The time frame that you can actually maximize your loan ability, as well as that's how you can actually build the portfolio to its greatest potential.
Maybe, right, we can also explain to the audience the concept of leverage. So maybe George can explain, like, why is leveraging...
We have a new moderator.
I want to give George some airtime.
Okay, so there's
I think everyone knows already.
Okay, no, there's two sets of questions here. One is that Yuron mentioned that your compound annual growth rate is much higher if you choose to leverage rather than paying full cash. Okay, before George answer, right? So George, I need to maybe share with our audience, like, why is it better, even if, let's say, example, you have $1 million, why is it more disadvantageous to fully pay $1 million on this property rather than paying a 25%, which is $250,000, and then loan 75% from the bank, and then have that balance $750,000 do something else for you? So later, you can share with our audience.
Sure.
Now, why is it that the CAGR is higher on a leveraged property is because we are talking about compound annual growth rate on a cash-on-cash return. That means we're talking about your initial investment, which is that 25% versus the yield that you get. So naturally, your yield is much higher. If you fully pay a property, but your yield, basically in terms of the gross yield that you receive, is the same compared to a leveraged property. So naturally, when you look at a fully paid property, you're investing more with this yield, but here you're investing lesser initially with the same yield. So naturally, the CAGR is much higher right here. Okay, George, I'll pass to you on Grace's question. Like, why is it better to leverage?
I'll try to speak of the nuggets inside. So I think when, let's say, you have $1 million and you just need $250,000 for the down payment,
right,
that means you're already buying into a property that, say, assuming you can have a CAGR of 6%. Whereas, if you put all the $1 million inside, your growth rate is still the same actually. And if let's say you have 250,000 inside, the growth rate is at 6%. The remaining 750,000, right, you can split into different basket. If let's say you want to go into something that is more aggressive, you can buy into like the US stock market. Recently, it reaches a 52-week high after all the quarterly earnings seasons. And some of the growth rates are maybe annually at about 15%. So you can maybe park like 250,000 inside like US stocks. And then the other 500,000, if let's say you, okay, I don't want to be so aggressive, I want to be very, very conservative, I can just simply put it into like Singapore Savings Bond 4%, or I buy into REITs at about 4 to 6% kind of yield, and it's extremely safe, or rather, historically, it has been quite safe. And I think in that way, once you diversify, maybe your overall growth per annum, it can be even like 10 or 15% after you analyze everything, instead of putting all the money in and then, you know, you just have a 6% all in. Even after you less off the interest rate, and in Singapore, only recently when the interest rate rise up a lot, then people deem it as a bit more risky. And then they'll be thinking, hey, should I go and pay off everything because the interest rate is high? But I would say the interest rate is probably short term, which I think later we'll be touching about the interest rates condition right now in Singapore. And once it normalizes again, I think it won't stay there for long.
Great. Yeah. Thanks for sharing the first benefit of leveraging. Yeah.
This is also the same reason, right? Why, let's say, not just for first-time home buyers who have, like, let's say, $1 million, they think, should I put the entirety of $1 million or should I just pay the down payment and then I leverage the rest, right? This is also the same kind of concept when, let's say, we have clients and then I think, like, you know, when they have... Sorry, when they leverage on the bank and then they want to pay off in full cash.
Very popular.
Suddenly like thinking about the nuggets. Okay, anyway. So then they will be asking like, actually, I have the cash now. I don't want to be thinking about monthly mortgage month on month. You know, I want to go into retirement mode. Can I just use this $1 million, pay off the mortgage completely, and then I just, you know, relax and stay in the home. So generally in these circumstances, we also use the concept of leveraging to explain to the clients, right, that, okay, one thing that we can consider is that, you know, not putting the money in. So firstly, whatever George has mentioned, right? But secondly, it's also very powerful that when we leverage on this money, the monthly mortgage stays the same for the remaining, like, 15, 20, 25 years. But the value of the dollar gets bigger, right? So inflation will make the value of the dollar bigger and it kind of erodes your debt that way. So maybe like when you get your mortgage 20 years ago or 15 years ago, maybe $1,000 is a very big sum. But maybe in the future, this $1,000 will not be a big sum at all, right? So inflation will actually erode this your debt. Yeah, so that is a powerful thing to think about as well. Yeah.
Yeah. The other two things to consider is number one, when you buy full cash, of course, we are assuming that you can buy full cash, like assuming that you are very, very rich, very, very young. If not, like you are in, let's say, a pre-retirement phase, then I think that's okay because anyway, we are not trying to maximize the leverage at that moment because of the life stage. But in summary, it's number one, when you pay down fully, right, you realize that your net worth doesn't change. Net worth is our assets minus our liabilities. Mm. If today you pay down a $1 million property, you have $1 million asset, zero liability. If today you only use $350,000 to do a 25% down payment, right? Mm. So you own a $1 million property, right? But actually, because there is a $750,000 of liability, which is your loan, you have $250,000 of down payment, but you still have $750,000 of cash. Mm. So in summary, your net worth is the same, $1 million. Next thing will be to understand that I think liquidity is very important in terms of your portfolio growth because if today I would rather that you hold more cash to give you more flexibility in terms of paying down or other investments like what George mentioned.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. So George talked about the first benefit of leveraging, which is of course the alternative yield that you can get with your balanced cash that you have on hand.
Yep.
Grace talked about the fact that real estate is an asset that eats inflation for breakfast, meaning that not only does your real estate tend to have a probability of appreciating in terms of value with inflation, secondly is that your debt is also eroded with inflation because you are paying down future mortgage installments with money that is having lower and lower power because inflation is something that is prevalent in the globally. The $1,000 that you have today will buy you lesser things in 10 years time. So similarly, for example, my mom used to pay $600 for her HDB that she bought in 1981. Today, she can even come and tell me that, hey, Arvin, the $600 that I'm paying just a couple of years back, I mean, her HDB is fully paid. She just says that it feels so little now. Like, in the past, $600 was a big deal for her, but now $600 seems like you can't buy much thing with $600. And she actually regretted buying an executive maisonette back then. She said that she had just stretched a little bit because she actually could afford, but she just wanted to play safe and bought a 4-room flat. So she sort of regretted because now the value of a 4-room versus the EM is very different. Okay. So
your mom called you Arvin.
Call you Arvin. Melvin, my son called Arvin. Then all my relatives started calling me Arvin and it changed to Arvin. A-B-I-N. So
at any point in that time, did it change to Arvin?
No.
Anyway, since you like to say mock.
Sorry. And then of course, Yu Rong touched on the point of leveraging debt. What was your point just now?
About
number
liquidity.
One, net worth don't show liquidity.
Net worth expansion, but liquidity. Okay. The fourth point is that I believe in this theory called the outsource theory. Meaning that leveraging, because of the fact that it's an asset that is recognized internationally, is a property that banks love it as a highest level of collateral because it's a physical asset that they can actually confiscate if, let's say, you fail to make your monthly mortgage. Yep. So technically, because of this status of property being an asset that is recognized internationally and banks love the leveraging point to issue you a mortgage loan, you can outsource this risk to insurance because that is why mortgage insurance and term insurance can technically be used as an instrument to cover your risk of owning the 75% so-called good debt in the sense of the mortgage. Because in any essence, if you have $1 million, you keep $750,000 in your bank and use this to pay for your monthly installment. Of course, there's interest incurred. And take note that the interest for a property is very different from interest from personal loans and things like that. Because interest for real estate is calculated until the day that you sell the property. So if you take a 30-year or 25-year loan, if you sold the property at the 10-year mark, you're paying interest up to that 10-year mark. Of course, there is like a amortization kind of figure, but real estate is one of the best form of leveraging too in terms of the interest balance with your principal. Okay, so coming back to the outsourcing part is that you should take a $750,000 mortgage insurance against your $750,000 mortgage loan because if, let's say, tomorrow, touch wood, something happened to you and you pass away, technically speaking, the mortgage insurance can cover that debt fully and you don't have to pass that risk to your family. Now, and your $750,000 in the bank is still available as an inheritance for your family rather than the fact that your full $1 million is trapped in the property that your family is staying. And if you were to pass on tomorrow, there'll be no money in your bank, even though you have a fully paid property, but maybe your family will have to sell that property in order to enjoy some cash to sustain them for the next 30 years. But rather, if you use mortgage insurance to cover and outsource that risk to the insurance company, you will have a fully paid property and you still have $750,000 that you can pass on to your spouse and your kids. So that is the outsourcing benefit.
The mortgage insurance that, of course, that we mentioned over here, right? Please do not go and get mortgage reducing insurance that tacks on to a specific property. Don't go and get whole life kind of insurance. We are talking about specific term insurance. Because why you use term insurance? Because this is probably not the only property that you're going to own, right? So a mortgage insurance that is tacked to the property, right? Once that property is sold, the insurance ends. So what we want to know is, of course, insurance, we know that when the younger that we purchase, your premiums is lower. Second thing is, when we grow older, there might be additional health conditions that might not help us to cover certain things. So that's why term insurance is better. Most value for money term insurance, if you are a Singaporean, just go for the group insurance from your MINDEF. It's only like less than $100, you can cover $1 million. That's the lowest term insurance coverage. So everybody should get one.
Great. Okay. So we touched on the topic of leverage. Now we want to move to the part about frameworks. So let's talk about frameworks on how can a young couple save money. Of course, there's a lot of framework. There's like 50, 30, 20 rule. There's the pay yourself first framework. GPT. Yes. There's the envelope system. There is like the snowball method. There's also like things like, you know, 30 days rule to curb any impulse purchases. Or right. I mean, like, there's even this
right,
thing called the latte.
Before we talk about saving, right?
Yeah.
We should talk about earning. I think
sure,
that,
we'll
yeah.
come to that. I want to pass on to our producers, of course, Cephas and
Daniel.
Talk about all of these 10 methods, right? Which methods have you tried in terms of savings?
The cook at home method. Very cute.
These 10 methods, all right.
The work until 10 p.m.
Yeah,
for
we cannot see anything.
Let me increase this for you. Okay. First one is budgeting. Of course, that's very common. Second one is pay yourself first. Pay yourself first means that when your paycheck comes in, you pay yourself like in a separate account as a form of forced savings, and that money you won't touch. And the rest, you try to survive the balance month with the rest. So for example, this pay yourself method is usually people have two sets of accounts. One account is to receive their salary, then they will pay themselves a fixed sum. That account is untouched. Then the balance in the salary account, they'll use it to sustain.
You just like spend after what you have saved.
Yes, something like that.
Yeah.
Something like that. Okay.
We love.
Yeah, maybe let's talk about this. Pay yourself 50, 30, 20. There's now this new method called the latte method.
Oh, yes.
Which is, don't buy latte, just come to PRB office to drink the free coffee.
Starbucks.
There's 30-day rule method. Cash-only method means to cut out all your credit cards so that you don't impulsively spend on your credit card. Mm. Yeah, so, and also the snowball method is to pay off your debt. Yeah, so what are some of the methods that you have used, Daniel?
Personally, I use the pay yourself first method as well as 50-30-20 rule. So I think like 50%, yeah, so like 50% is for my use for like the essential spending. 30% is like for like let's say Grab
fun.
By the way, Daniel is the king of Grab. Yeah, what is your status on Grab? Is it like the
platinum?
Platinum.
Oh my goodness.
I heard from the CEO they wanted to make one more tier just for me.
This should be called the Grab factor.
How often do you take Grab?
Every day.
So there should be the 11th rule, the Grab rule.
So 30% is for like your Grab and stuff. Okay. How about your 20%?
Yeah, so 20% is for my savings lah. Actually, I would say
should you flip the other way around? 50% savings.
Yeah, actually 50% is my savings lah, to be honest. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
That's very good actually.
Yeah. Very, very good.
Imagine you save 15% on a Grab, right? You will have a 65% saving rate ratio.
But he can't reach the next level. That's what he wants.
But it's about quality of life.
He values time more.
Yeah.
He buys time.
Because he stays far.
Time is money, money is time.
Mm. Exactly. Can you imagine, right, while you're on the ride back home, right, you're editing videos. Then you knock off
then
1 hour earlier.
Can you imagine you just stay here? Then you don't even need a Grab.
Yeah, he did for what? Before Leonard Convention.
You don't even consider staying, though.
Okay, coming back
stay
to this
awake.
One.
Okay, how about yourself, Seth? Which are the methods you have used?
Wow, I actually don't use any of the methods.
Okay, what is your personal method? Or do you even save at all?
Okay,
what is savings, man?
No. I actually have this like investment savings plan.
Right.
Which
how
is
does
like,
that work?
So like stash away. Monthly it will just deduct a certain amount.
Oh this so, is like stash pay away, your investment account first.
Invest first, spend later.
Something like that, like. Yeah. So that amount will go into like some stocks that will.
Is it at the start of the month when your salary comes in? Like, is it a force or do you do it at the end of the month?
It's an automatically deducted thing. So I don't even have to bother about it.
Oh, okay.
So it's like managed by a robo, like robo advisor.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's.
So you like compound?
Yeah.
Right.
Correct. So that's that. Then for me, I try not to. I mean, for me, most of my expenses will either go into food or.
Then you hitch a
transport.
You hitch a Grab with Daniel
Yeah. So with.
We do.
Grab do it because they are staying very close to one another.
Yeah. Correct. So
with me around, right, I helped Dan save 50% of his Grab fees.
Oh, because y'all share.
So correct. We will alternate our...
We'll alternate who is the one that will book the Grab.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. Wow, that's a nice Grab share system.
Immediately, Daniel says 50%.
And you also expenses. Say 50%.
Wow. Yes.
And it slows down your tier. Slows down your reach to the tier.
It's a carpool system.
Yeah, it's a carpool system. So
awesome.
It's
very then you'll Grab here every day also.
He will Grab here every day. Like, I will take the train.
Oh, okay. So you save more.
Yes.
Awesome. Okay, great. So, George, how about you? What's your savings method?
Okay, so last time, right, I don't really spend a lot.
When was last time?
It's about 10... Oh, shucks, I'm revealing my age.
When was it?
10 years ago. So when I started my first
job... How old were you back then?
25, though.
Were you married?
Hamson Young Boy.
Were you married?
No.
How long have you been married?
I've been married since 2016 until now.
Right.
Yeah.
That's like how many years? 7 years.
Yes.
So short only?
Yes.
Okay.
It felt long. But it's a good thing. Yeah.
Okay. So back then, what was your saving method?
Oh, so back then, right, whatever amount of money I have, right, I just went into IPO. So last time, right, is you can just buy IPO. I'm not sure whether you're aware. You can just buy IPO. Last time, don't have things like what ah.
Robo advisor, all this.
Yeah, okay. Don't have. So you can just go to the ATM and then you just like press and then you bid for the IPO.
Right.
So I set up my investment account quite young before I started work because I planned for it. So I have my CDB account. And then I also use my mom's CDB account so that I can bid for the same IPO on two different accounts. So that was how I saved by just buying into stocks. And in Singapore stocks is quite relatively cheap. It's $1 plus $2 per share. You just minimum like 100 shares. So you sure have the money. It's just whether you want to put that money into the stocks and then you just buy into it.
Right.
So,
has that helped you?
Yes, that helped me actually tremendously because, I would say, back then I didn't spend a lot because I worked quite a lot and then majority of the money is all in the stocks. So I think about, 60% are all like into the stocks.
Right.
Yeah.
So that actually helped you with your first property.
That helped me when I did a career switch. And then in between, there isn't any form of income. And then that helped me a lot to tide me through.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Yes.
In terms of dividends and in terms of when I liquidate, because IPO is usually at a discounted rate.
Right. Yeah. In the past.
Yes, correct. In the past. Yeah. Yeah.
And that was like a form of forced savings for you.
Yes, that's correct. Forced savings.
And that was like uni days.
Okay, so uni days, not yet. Because uni days, right, I remember back then I was a student, I don't have money. So I only give tuition. And Lehman Brothers crashed. COE was just $2. Genting just launched IPO, but I got no money. Then my friend that stays in land property, all buying stocks. So I can only watch. So from then, I tell myself, okay, I'm going to have investment account. And then once I receive my paycheck, I'm going to go all in.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
So benefited from my friend.
Great.
So got the friend factor.
Thanks for sharing. How about Yuron, what's your savings method in the past?
I want to share something that it took me maybe like 3 years to figure out. Okay, of course, you know, like real estate is my first proper work. And then real estate, because it's commission based, right? So actually every month, sort of like the money that comes is different, right? And so I realized that initially I was trying to use the jar method, meaning that every time a commission comes, I will split 20% go into my business account, 20% goes to my savings, and then like a percentage goes to my spending, another like 20% is supposed to set aside for like investment and all that. Then I realized that when I do that, right, sometimes there will be months, right, where my expenses account is not enough. Then I have to go and dig out a bowl from the other account, right? So after that, I script that. I chose something simpler, which is actually when the income comes, it goes into what I call like a holding account, right? So I think this is good for like freelancers and all that. Because actually real estate, I realized that when I first started, right, I was doing mainly new launches and commission. I closed the case today, I get paid 1 year later. So the cash flow was not good. So what happens, I change it to the other method, like so holding income and then I pay myself a fixed salary every month. And then from there, I find it easier to apportion my money in terms of expenditure as well as savings, right? So I think right now, like it's the lowest hanging fruit method. Like basically, just immediately auto-transfer a certain savings element. Then that settles the I try to pull it out and then put it in like, let's say like, you know, like, in terms of like the different instruments directly so that it doesn't appear in a bank account. Cause when you see money there, you have the
tendency to spend
it. Yes, have the desire to spend it. So you need to park it elsewhere.
Oh, yeah. So you use like, I mean, this is fantastic for commission earners, freelancers. You adopt a mindset as a salary to yourself, a fixed salary, and then the rest you can set it aside for your business expenses. But of course, using your salary, then that will categorize your family expenses and all that kind of stuff, right?
Mm.
And of course, if you don't see it, you tend not to have the temptation to spend it as well. Yeah. So I think
because no money to spend it. It's all like in the
you hide
broker account, in the crypto account, then the crypto account crash.
Yeah, that's a very good method. How about Grace? What was your method of savings like in the past and now?
Oh my god. Actually
you have a spending method, then you can share, then we can avoid that.
Oh my god. Actually I mean, if I say then the people will like flame me in the comments, right? Because I don't save. I've never used any of these methods.
That's why just now she mentioned one thing. She don't care about saving. She care about earnings. That's why you say earning is more important than savings.
Yeah, it's okay. We'll talk about that later. Talk about, I mean, if there's no savings framework, then it's okay. Just
no savings or no savings.
How about at least this? Save on utilities.
Utilities?
She don't know what is utilities.
This one is actually
off your lights.
No, I believe in like, okay, so my situation I think is a bit different because I started earning a lot at a young age, I feel. Because last time I teach tuition, right, it's like, I think when I was in uni, right, or before
1 hour
uni,
is like $30, $40.
It was like 75
per
hour. And then I was like teaching ballet.
Teach ballet, $75 an hour.
No. The teaching, the $75 per hour is teaching English and math to kindergarten. Two kindergarten siblings.
Wow, my first part-time job was $4.50.
Can I know how are they doing now?
Mine was
I don't know.
An hour.
$2.
Oh yeah.
Selling kids' clothing.
Okay, but I want to say, right, I also worked in McDonald's before for like $5 an hour. So I started earning earning young and I started earning like quite a fair bit. But my situation is different because I'm also the oldest child. So I had to take care of like the family also. So with the money that I earn, right, I pay for my siblings like piano. I pay for their tuition fees. So like I had no savings because anything that I earn, right, is always like paying something.
Yeah,
but something that I did, I think, is that very quickly, right, the moment I have money to like buy like, let's say insurance, then I'll quickly try to like pay my insurance, like secure the insurance thingy. Then let's say now, right, like the moment I feel that I'm almost ready to get my first home, right, I'll just go ahead and buy it. Even if like, I won't think so much to like hesitate whether, you know, like do I have enough savings or I must save up X amount before I can commit. So I like, while we were doing this podcast, right, I suddenly remember one of our colleagues, Jolene, right? Because I was standing there and I was like, shucks, like I really emptied out like every single cent to go and buy my first like home, right? Then I was like, and then the reno and all that. Then Jolene was like, oh, so do you like feel like actually it's too early? Like you should have waited. Maybe like wait half a year, then you save up more, then you'll be at a more comfortable place. But then I told her, right, you see, as of this point, right, I have not even moved into like my first home. And okay, so it's a resale HDB. Technically, you have a 5-year MOP, right? So at this point, the house is still renovating. I have not even moved in and I cleared like 10% of this MOP already. So to me, like, it's always like, once I can even barely make it, right, I'll just go all the way to do it because I feel that like that is my form of saving, like investing into like things and whatever.
You always maximize your potential, lah. I mean, like it's in like you just deploy everything.
Deploy what? Deploy,
yeah, I mean,
all in
the funds are basically you just deploy like, and then you invest in your family.
Correct.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. Thanks for sharing. I want to come back to Cephas and Daniel. So let's assume, how are you guys, by the way, Cephas and Daniel? because we want to move to the age, want to move to the topic age. Of the
younger than me, younger
the,
than
the earnings. Being single first, then we talk about earnings. How are you guys?
28 this year.
Right. Thanks for sharing with us. Is that your true age? Great.
All 28 right. Single and available.
Okay, assuming, which I will. I mean. Okay, just assuming in the next 7 years, maybe if, let's say, you decided to remain single, right? Then by the time you will be eligible for a HDB already, you can get a BTO two-room flat as a single person or a resale HDB. So assuming in the next 7 years that you remain single, what will be your plan? And let's say you need the next 7 years to store up your down payment. At age 35, what will be your choice? And let's say you have three choices. You can get maybe a private property for yourself, a HDB resale, or BTO two-room flat. As a single person, what would be your choice? Projecting 7 years later in the year 2030.
I say in terms of property type. La.
Yes. Assuming you are single.
It would probably be either... Okay, in terms of what I can afford, probably is either a BTO or a resale.
Okay, or maybe you have three choices. Maybe by then you can afford a $1 million private property because you have 7 years to save up, example. Yeah, what would be your choice out of these three?
Oh, that changes things. No, sorry, because I remember during my first year in PLB, and like Melvin went through the whole like calculations of like, oh, if you were to buy a condo property, you know, and worst case scenario, it doesn't appreciate. And then like he did all the calculations. Like, okay, so this is how much you were sort of like save in a sense on the property. Then my jaw dropped. I was like, what the heck? Like, why wasn't I told this earlier?
Did you pick up your jaw?
I have to lah.
I was giving them a finance lesson to the media team.
Yeah. So like probably would go that route if it's possible lah.
Right, yeah. Right.
What about you?
So it'll be a condo for you.
If I can lah.
Okay, yeah. Awesome. How about Daniel? Out of the three.
I think same thing. If I'm still single in 7 years, right? I'll buy probably like a two bedder. Continue staying in my parents' house.
Then maybe a two-bedder condo.
Two-bedder condo.
Then you rent out.
Yeah, then rent it out, but continue staying in my parents' home.
Awesome.
Yeah. Ideally, that's the...
So will you pay your mom rental?
He will pay for the electrical bill.
I had a conversation with my mom before because... We just had a random chat about this. Then she's like, okay, she doesn't want to move out from this house now. This is like, she's going to stay there. Then I asked her, okay, then what if we all move out? Then she's like, crap. Because she's like, oh, I want, she kind of wants, she likes it when we're there, because it's a lot of people and that crowd is there. So I was like thinking, okay, so that's and then I also had a conversation with Dan about, buying a condo and then renting out that style.
Right.
I was like, yeah, okay, that's actually an option also.
Awesome. Great. Actually, there's many out-of-the-box options. Thanks for sharing. Let's move on to the real person who is 35 years old this year. Come. Joel, let's go to the mic. 35. Have you bought a property already? Did you just bought? I heard rumors that you just bought a property. What do you buy, Joel? Share for audience.
I bought a three-room HDB flat.
Right. So what is your plan as a single?
I'm going to stay in this HDB room. But then at the same time, I'm going to rent out a room for...
You know, cash flow.
As a single, there's one extra room there. Right. So I'm going to rent out for...
So who will be the potential tenant?
That is a very out-of-the-box mindset because when you stay in your... I mean, as a single, you stay in your HDB, you stay in the master room, example. Or you can even stay in the common room. Rent out a master room for higher rent.
Yeah.
That can actually be an additional level of income. I mean, how much is... Do you intend to stay in the master room or common room?
It's going to be a common room for me.
Mm. Okay, so you rent out like the... Oh, it's a three...
There's no master.
It's a 3i, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so you rent out one of the room. How much can the room fetch now, Yurong, based on your sensing?
Oh, I'm not an expert in room renter.
Which area is it?
Which estate?
Eunos.
Isn't it MRT?
Correct.
Awesome. Okay, what's the room rental rate? Common room.
I think,
I think if you have like fully furnished.
No, we got 800 now.
No, room, eh?
If it's fully furnished, room, eh? You include utility, include Wi-Fi, got air condition.
$1,000 at least.
Yeah, $1,000. Right? And then you, one of the selling point, you know, stay in with a good looking bachelor as your housemate. $10,100.
So this can
provide a cleaning service. Like you get a part-time cleaner once a week, then help your roommate to clean.
He clean himself, ah.
You can charge $1,200. Provide good internet. let them wash clothes every day. Yeah, be a good landlord. I think $1,200 no problem.
And then you can even cook for them. Yeah.
So $1,200
very high.
Monthly mortgage.
No, make the room nice.
Morning. Yeah, must make it super nice.
Then you cook for them.
So
at the same time, you can also find your soulmate.
You get a place to stay. You get your monthly mortgage covered.
How much is your monthly mortgage?
Can you share with us? Cash flow to spend.
How much is your monthly mortgage?
Before minus off CPF.
Total.
Total, 900 plus.
Fully covered by CPF, right?
Positive cash flow.
900 plus is in like, you downpay a lot.
Downpay more than.
How much you bought? How much?
3.
Okay, so the mortgage is $900, which you have balance CPF to pay off.
Yes.
Okay, great. So your $1,000 to $1,200, there's another out of the box method.
Extra income.
Go and get a car. Use that $1,000 to pay for the car and then go and fetch Daniel and Cephas and charge them. Let them pay you.
Yeah.
The grab fee.
Good idea.
I think that sounds good.
So you get a car for free. You get a car for free.
And then you can choose the tenant so that you can potentially find your soulmate. Mm.
Yeah, actually.
Anybody looking to stay in Eunos near the MRT, you know, with a handsome hunky guy?
Only females.
You can comment down below. Yeah. Can cook.
PM us for more details.
He will clean after you cook.
Yeah, I have helped number of singers to like do up their portfolio. To find love. No, I'm not a... What's that thing called?
Love guru.
So actually, I think like what I will share with Cyphers and Daniel, right? So I have a number of clients, right? So actually what they do is they just buy a condo first. So like one of my clients, previously we started off with a one beta, 500 plus thousand. Of course now, you can't find a 500 thousand plus property, can be 600 plus thousand, right? So we start off already 3 years later, we make some profit, capital appreciation. And then we sell it off. And then we change to a 2-bedroom. And then he's intending to sell down the road in like 1 year's time again. With that flexibility that maybe he might consider going to buy a HD after a wait-out period. Mm.
Right. Thanks for sharing. Thanks, Joel, for sharing, by the way. And maybe let's come to the last topic. Yeah, so Grace, you want to talk about it's not how much you save, it's how much you earn. This theory. Come share a little bit.
Okay, I'm not saying it's not how much you save. Definitely how much you save is still important. It doesn't matter how much you earn at the end of the day if it's like a bottomless, like, you know, spending. But I think that something equally important to recognize for young people nowadays is not just about how much you can save, you know, it's also about how much you can earn. Because let's say if you are always earning the same amount, even no matter how much you try to save, how much expenses you try to cut, you are limited at an amount, right? But let's say you work on your skills, you work on yourself, you know, you find a side hustle, you build your career, you build your skill set, then I think that, that is something worthy to look into. Yeah, like how to earn more. Yeah.
Right. Great. Yuong, any final thoughts before we end our episode?
We're not going through the newspaper articles.
Yes. Maybe just to end the episode with, what is the most impactful news for you for the past 2 weeks? Start with George first.
We changed topic already.
Yeah.
George has some advice.
Oh, okay. No, sorry. No, you have some advice for single buyers as well as... earning or savings method.
I think we talk about it. Really.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Let's move to the final talk.
I got advice.
Sure.
Not about savings, right? But just about in general for this topic,
right.
Is that sometimes, like, I feel like if you want to make a decision to do something, then as long as you've calculated, you've had it planned out, then I think you can take the leap of faith to do it. I feel that people always hesitate, and in this hesitation, right, you lose out on a lot of opportunities. It's a lot of time cost. So if you are ready, if you want to do something and you have had it planned out, then I feel like shouldn't hesitate, and you should just like move forward with it, especially after you've already, you know, thought it through and consulted like the people you need to speak to. Yeah.
I have 2 points for spending habits. Number one, have a credit card, but don't spend on a credit card, right? So the purpose of having a credit card, maybe you just load a very low monthly bill, like maybe paying for your handphone bill, for example. This to build your credit score, because actually when you want to take your housing loan, right, you realize that actually when they check your record, previously I had the same mindset. Hey, if I don't have any loan, right, I will be the most... most eligible in the sense of like taking a property loan. But actually, it's considered higher risk because they don't know what is my track record, what is my payment profile kind of habit, right? So just have a credit card. And then for myself, I like to, every time there's a pay raise, I will go and increase my credit limit because it offers other things that I can use down the road. We won't cover in this episode. But then the other thing to note is in terms of spending wise, I would say that like, use debit card lah. So don't spend on the credit card so that you will know exactly what is being spent on. Because when you use a credit card, you most of the time you will spend much more.
Mm.
Because you only need to clear and pay at the end of the month. It's easy to swipe. Whereas the debit card, you at least you know that it is itemized and deducted immediately on the day of spending.
Yeah. Which is why sometimes I still prefer to use cash. Which is why I always have a stack of cash in my pocket.
Mm. Let me check. Wow, then the vendor...
For durian.
Then the vendor will be like, hey, nowadays, we're wireless.
So I always have like a stack of cash in my pocket.
Then you still need to let people change money for you.
How many pockets you have?
2 lah.
Oh.
So it's easier to buy durians lah. Okay.
What's
I agree.
The joke? I don't get it.
No, because they always say I like to buy durians. Then every time when durian come, I'll just take out a stack of cash to pay the person. It's like... very scary. They say, hey, why do you have a stack of cash like $1,000 in your pocket? Yeah, because I like to use cash as well, just to control like spending with the credit card.
Oh, I realized that when I first started out, right?
Right.
I actually used the envelope portion.
Cash, by the way.
This was safekeeping.
So what happened to like actually because at that point of time, right, when I first started, I needed to make sure the cash flow was clean and proper. So I would draw out the entire month's spending. I split into a weekly envelope. So I only put the cash in the envelope, right? So at the start of the week, I only take this. This will be my budget. I can, however I spend it, but I cannot overspend.
Is the envelope still in your car?
No lah. Somewhere else. I already upgraded from the envelope.
System.
To e-envelope.
System.
Wow. Very good.
Sure.
That's, yeah, I mean, I'm not like you. You know, you make $70 an hour as your tuition work. You know, my first one was $4.50. Then I went to the kopitiam. The cheapest meal was $5. Then I was like, wow, I stand for 1 hour. Then in order to get one meal, I have to pay more than my 1 hour's worth. So that was at a point of time I realized the importance. That was when I was in JC, the importance of increasing income. And that's why I chose real estate as my first career.
Mm.
Yeah.
Right. Mm. Great. For me, basically, I got married at 24, right? So, I bought my first property at 25 with $534 in my bank. Yeah. So I bought a HDB resale because I was very sure back then. So back to like some of the summation of what we discussed, I was very sure back then to get married. So basically, me and my wife, we took the HDB housing grant. Then we bought the first resale 4-room flat. And of course, for me, that was like the kickstart of my journey in real estate. And I wasn't a realtor back then. So of course now, looking back, I think like time is so important because time is the only commodity we cannot buy back. Yep. So something to take note that all this discussion, there's one final factor is that your time is so precious. And I've seen like over my past 16 years of helping clients to make decisions in real estate is that a lot of people, even in transition phases from one property to another, or maybe just going into the first or second property, they spend probably a little bit too long a time to make a decision. And it can actually stagnate over 24, 36 months and they lose out on a lot of opportunities as well as valuation growth. And sometimes your trigger events in your life will change. Maybe example, while you were stagnating through your decision, I would say, what's that word called? Decision...
Paralysis.
And you had a trigger event like maybe you are retrenched, or maybe you had a job change, or maybe something happened in your family. And sometimes because of this, you lose that time that you could have made a good decision back then. So I think time is it should be anchored as the base of your decision matrix.
I think sometimes when people delay like purchasing assets, and then they see that they have this huge amount of cash sitting in their bank account, and they might it might affect their spending habits, where because they have this huge amount of money and then they go and spend on other things that might not be appreciating, right, and then it will erode, you know, at the end of the day, their affordability.
I think one way to help in terms of like, you know, like overcoming any decision paralysis is to take note that actually we are not trying to make a perfect decision. We just want to make a good enough decision. That's all. Because actually, when you consistently do a good enough decision, all these things will compound together and life will be quite different because of this like compounded decision, even though they're just good enough.
All right. Great.
Same thing lah. If you compound your bad decisions, then...
Yeah, that's why we say minimum good enough. Yeah. Going to be perfect.
Okay.
I think so. I really believe in this. Yeah.
Right. Okay, Grace. End our banter with one news that was lodged in your mind over the past 2 weeks. Was there any news or not any news that was impactful enough, or even no impact was okay?
HDB launches.
Okay, move on.
Reserve residences, 71% sold.
Shocking, I was going to say
500
that.
Plus units sold. As in, I didn't expect that kind of outcome. I mean, it's the best performing launch in terms of percentage. Next highest was 53% at 300 plus units, which is Tembusu Grand. And so, good job.
And I lost because I anticipated $2,800. It didn't come true.
I predicted 2,500. So I'm quite accurate. So it was 2,460.
No, Bengyu predicted very low.
2,300. 2,400.
So he hit the jackpot, right?
Oh, yeah.
Correct launch, right? You predicted 2,526. Yeah, I think fantastic project. Keep a lookout for our PRB insights. But anyway, we just ended our PRB Landed Convention. Just want to thank everybody that participated. Thankful that you came. We had 400 over audiences that bought the tickets, came and supported us, and hope that we added value. Also our sponsors, developers, as well as our architects, builders, and different partners, Steinway, HProp, thankful to our internal media, HQ, IST, and our core team. Of course, Grace was the team lead to lead the core team for this event. Thank you, Grace. Give her a round of applause. Steffers was the main producer as well. Give her a round of applause. Great. So, very thankful that we made this happen together. So, we want to see you on the next NOTG Banter. And meantime, take care. Bye.